How's it
hey,
going?
Hey, what's going on, man? Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. Feels like it's been forever since we've done this, but it's actually only been a couple of weeks, right?
I went back and checked, and the last time we were on was our glint cap. It's been a couple of weeks.
Couple of weeks. Yeah.
Glad to be
back. Maybe no Jordan tonight. I think he had something come up. He'll try to jump in if he gets back home in time. Mm-hmm, uh-huh. And yeah, it is good to be back. So episode 96, we're going to talk about historical beers tonight, which is a topic neither of us have brewed. So we're going to bullshit through this. Kind of brings me back to what we did or how we did our old cider episode. But but before we get into that, we got other shit to cover, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We have some stuff. The Michigan Beer Cup judging happened.
That did. It happened the weekend of the 3rd and 4th of June. It was amazing. We had an awesome turnout of judges.
100% turnout. 100%. Over 100%. Everybody that registered showed up and then some. So yeah, it was really great.
Yeah, I was really, really encouraged by that and happy to see the turnout and the stewards and the staff that showed up to help out. They really made that day amazing. I know there's a lot of posts out on the Beer Cup site and you know, good comments all around. You know, people seeming to think that it went smoothly. They had a good time. It was well run, so I'm thankful for that. This was our first big comp. I mean, you and I have run little tiny comps a couple of times, and we helped out with Beer Cup last year.
Yeah.
But no, I'm happy for what we pulled off this time, and I'm looking forward for some improvements that we can make to next year.
We got a lot of nice emails afterwards, so that was really.
Wow, I totally missed those.
Well,
I have to go back and look.
We got a couple of emails. I guess it was a lot of Facebook comments. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. So
you do better on staying up on the emails than I did. So yeah, I mean, the competition is done. The judging is done. Score sheets have been sent out or published on the website. We are going to send an email out this week.
Yeah.
With winners. All right. Yeah. So we're going to notify winners, honorable mention and above, that they've got something. And then it's going to kind of go quiet for 6 weeks, 7 weeks until Michigan Homebrew Festival. So it's really important. The Beer Cup has been tied to the Homebrew Festival for as long as I can remember it. Probably for as long as either of them have been running in the current form that they are now. And so it was really important to keep that connection. We're going to have the award ceremony on August 19th,
I think.
Yeah.
Mid-afternoon.
Yep. 1-2 o'clock. We'll narrow that down and get the details out. Anybody that, participated in the competition is welcome to come to MHF on Saturday the 19th to be part of the award ceremony and, you know, of course, getting your medals and prizes if you've won those. You don't actually need to be a member of the Michigan Homebrew Festival or have a pass to the Michigan Homebrew Festival to attend the competition. But you do have to have that pass if you want to consume alcohol on premises. That's what they use to cover, you know, kind of you join the club and you get your ticket and then you can drink under that club insurance banner. So, but yeah, we're hoping that everybody that participated can come out. And yeah, we've still got some category sponsorships to sell. And so I think we're going to do some work on that in the next couple of weeks to, kind of finish out that and finish paying for the gold medal awards. But yeah, I was really, really pumped. So thank you for all the work you did with the website and the money and everything like that, Brian. I appreciate all that. And you let me do the spreadsheet and the paperwork and the shit that makes me happy.
Okay, good, I guess.
So that was awesome.
We also have new medals.
We do. Do you want to do that now?
Oh, I didn't even think about it until literally saying that just now.
Why not?
Do you have a picture like on your computer?
No, give me a second.
Okay. you're fine. You go do that and I'll talk about whatever else. So Lori says, should Santa come out to give
some back
beer winners? Should Santa come out?
Should come out to give the seasonal beer winners?
Yes. Did we have any season? We had seasonal beer.
We did.
And while I'm on this topic and before you even go there, Lori and Cass River, they're doing a holiday. I can't remember the category, Lori, but they have a single subcategory, like winter spice beer competition coming up sometime in the fall. 30C, thank you. Lori, if there's a website for that or a Facebook post, shoot that to us. We'll put that on the Facebook page too. Winter seasonal, what were you saying? We had how many entries, Jason?
I don't know off the top of my hand. I'm trying to pull up a spreadsheet.
You're fine. I'm sure it was like three.
But... It's not
many. we had 400, and I think we judged 425 entries.
435.
In a day and a half. So yeah, it was a crazy, crazy, crazy weekend.
Yeah. So I am going to take some nice pictures and put a post up on Michigan Beer Cup. But for those of you that watch the show here, I'm going to try to see if this works. You can see this is the new medal. So that is the gold medal. It has Michigan Beer Cup name on it, the year. And then we kept some of the elements from the past, the pint glass, apple, hops, barley, and then this other side of the circle over there is embossed with honeycomb. And it's pretty big, about as big as my palm. It's got some good heft to it. It could be heavier. I know we got a lot of this empty space here. So in future versions, we may make this thicker just to give it a little bit more heft. Nice. And then, of course, it does come with the custom printed Michigan Beer Cup ribbon. So, yeah, those are our new medals. We got those in. A few of them have been shipped off to Dan to make the best of show Michigan Homebrew Club of the Year plaques, which we'll give out.
Awesome.
And then, yeah, super excited about these. I'm glad. I'm happy how they turned out. The people that have looked at them so far have been happy. I think it's kind of cool to, like I said, represent the state of the shape. We've looked at a lot of other comp medals out there and kind of took some of the aspects of them, to try to improve on or build on and upgrade the medal. And so I think we did well with this, but we'll see after the post goes up on the actual beer cup site where all the beer cup people see it. And if they kind of, we'll see how they do. Yeah.
Thank you, Shana and Amy as well for their help with getting the metal design narrowed down.
Yeah. It was actually the hardest part of the comp so far for me, I think, is the multiple revisions and, kind of the pain and anguish of going over if we were making the right choices and stuff like that. But I think that we have a solid medal, and I think we've got something to build on in the future. So
awesome. Me too.
Beer Cup was awesome. We did 360 beer, probably like 40 some mead and 40 some cider.
Yeah. It was like 96 or something mead and cider total. Yeah.
I know we pulled some stats together.
They're on the Facebook page. We'll go look later. Yeah. Well, hey, as we wrap up, our beginning stuff, what are you drinking? We skipped it.
We did skip it. So I'm still lame and drinking a Hams.
There's nothing lame about that.
It's not lame. It's just I don't have anything. I am getting closer. So I've officially entered my temporary retirement phase of my career. I'm going to take a few months off, I believe. And I've got some house chores to do around here. And definitely some of those are on my chore list is brewing, to brew here at the new house and get back into it. So I am going to try to take advantage of this downtime.
You going to brew a historical beer?
I might. I might.
After reading, you know, the style guidelines and stuff, you know, in sort of preparation for the show, I'm actually kind of interested in making a few of these myself too. So.
I think I am too. We have some cautionary tales to kind of go over, you know, for those of you that want to brew these and enter them in competition, but we'll get into that. What are you drinking?
So I have a cider using historical ingredients. This is a Woodruff and pineapple cider, first pioneered by German immigrants in the 1850s. Not very well documented, but you know, I dug it up and made one, and I tell you what, man, it's amazing. It's great. Yeah, it's wonderful.
It is. I love that cider.
It's not quite as brown green. It's more of a vibrant green. The camera's not doing the cider any justice with this thing, probably. It is tasty though, if not a little sweet.
Oh yeah. So we're also, before we get in the show, I think we're gonna give an update on kind of what's coming for Michigan Brews too. We do that at the end. See, I'm already all screwed up.
It's been a couple weeks. It's fine.
I was going to say, you know, we're still trying to come up with ideas and plans for episode 100, meaning we haven't talked about it at all since the last show. So we do need to do that. Episode 100 is coming up in 4 more episodes.
Yeah.
So we've got to figure that out. And then we definitely want to, we've still got the list of things that we talked about at the beginning of the year that we're picking off of. This was actually one of them. When Brian reached out, you know, last week or the week before and said, let's do a show, we just kind of randomly selected one of the topics off the list. It didn't require.
Did you actually roll a die? You told me
I actually did. I did. That's right. This is roll for show. This was, awesome. I rolled a 15. This was 15th on the list, historical beers. And so this is why we're here.
We put it on the list because it was something that neither of us really knew a lot about. So we wanted to, you know, dig into it a little bit ourselves and then kind of come on and talk.
And that's why I know we talked about doing this last Monday, and then I think we got to like Monday afternoon and I'm like, you know what? I need to do more research and do some more reading. And that's why I asked you to bump it out a week, which I'm glad we did. I got to spend some time and I, you know, looking up stuff, and I know you did too. And it's interesting. I think anybody that's kind of you know, interested in BJCP or any of the guidelines and the styles and the more traditional styles should just go read the kind of the category description for category 27 historical beer, because it is all over the fucking place.
It is. And there's no subcategories either. It is 27. And then you just call out your beer.
And it encapsulates things like Goza's, Kentucky Commons, London Brown Ales, Pio Grigia's, Grodzicki's, pre-prohibition, Rogan beer, Shoddy. Like, those beers are so drastically different from each other.
I'll call out, it used to cover Goza. Goza actually it got moved out of historical in the 2021 guidelines.
You're right. I am looking at the 2015 guidelines. Sorry.
So many people started brewing Gozas again that they kicked it back out. Maybe not traditional. It's like fruited Goza, like mostly what you see these days and stuff. But I don't remember right off the top of my head where Goza got kicked to. But
I'm pulling up 2021. I can't believe it's actually a bookmark I have. I need to change it because I just clicked my bookmark for style guidelines and it was 2015. Oh, I'm going to find Goza now.
Goza still does sort of have a little bit of a base in a couple of these beers that I found. Like the Lichtenhainer is sort of like a smoked Goza, just without the coriander and the salt and stuff. Yep. And the Pivo Grodzicki, I think I got that right, is sort of like a like a goza, but with smoke, like kind of, but no sour character or coriander and stuff. Like it all kind of has that wheat base. So yeah, some interesting things that we'll kind of maybe pile into. Do you want to start? Like, yeah. do you want to hit them all? Like everything that's in 27 right now?
I mean, so, but I don't think that I feel like that the guidelines don't even capture everything that's in 27.
Oh, no, not at all.
So yeah, now that I've got it up here officially, the new 27 without goza. So we've got Keller Beer, Kentucky Common, the Lichtenhainer, London Brown Ale, Piwod Gradzicki, Pre-Prohibition Lager, Pre-Prohibition Porter, Roggenbier, and Soddy, right?
Yeah. And you actually have brewed a Soddy before.
I have. You're right. You are right.
So maybe we can work from the bottom up.
But then I would call out, too, that there's some others, a Kotbusser and Gruet are also, I think, would fit into this historical style that are not specifically represented in the written guidelines. But to be honest with you, they could just keep writing this forever. I mean, you've got shit like, you know, Dogfish Head doing like Midas Touch and Chicha. You know, those are both historical beers that they found, you know, the recipes either from, what was it, Egypt or Mexico, ancient beer brewing recipes that aren't represented here. But yeah, Soddy's. Soddy, I brewed one time. It's a historical Finnish farmhouse beer, typically brewed with juniper. And I think the grain bill characterization on it is heavy on the rye. So it's rye, juniper.
We should specify too that it's like that it's not necessarily just juniper berries. It's like whole like the branches. Yeah.
They take the branch. I watched the video of it. I think it was on Discovery. There was once a guy and even in their mash tun and what they used to filter the beer through, this guy, you know, in Finland was brewing a traditional soddy, and he like lined his tun with spruce branches to give it that first kind of layer, where he then added all of the grains on, and that's what he used to filter through. And then, yeah, when they're actually boiling the beer, or I'm sorry, the wort, they're either adding, you know, just whole boughs in there or spruce chips or all different kinds of, you know, things. I'm sure it's from various families. And then the cool thing in Finland, they have the yeast wreath, right? They like this wreath of wood blocks that's been passed down from generation to generation in this family, right, where they take it and they put it in their cooled wort, and it is what has the yeast that starts the fermentation. When the beer is done, they take it out and hang it up, and it waits for the next batch of beer.
That's often yeast that they use to like make bread and stuff too, I think. Yeah. Like it's kind of all the same. It's like it's just yeast.
It's just yeast. It's their yeast.
And I think those beers are often not even boiled. Like you get the bitterness that you get from the juniper, and like that's it. Like there's traditionally, I think, like no hops, right? Like,
yeah, I believe in that. In that particular style, there are no hops. It's kind of like a gruit in that way. I think when we did it, we did lightly hop it. So it wouldn't have been a traditional soddy. I'd have to go back and look at the notes. But no, traditionally, you know, you're looking for that woody, junipery characteristics with no hop. No, and then from the yeast, you know, being that kind of Nordic, North Europe hop characteristics, you're going to get that kind of clove, banana, spiciness. And I don't know where we went wrong with ours. I brewed it with an old member of Keepers, and he brought over the juniper from his property. But when we got the finished product, mine tasted like green peas. like mushy peas. Like yeah, I had a very mushy pea characteristic, and I thought, you know, this is terrible, and I dumped it out. And I don't actually know what he did with this.
One thing that I found that was interesting too, while reading just the style guidelines, not even like researching, you know, a little bit of the history of the style or something too, but I didn't actually realize how strong that these were. Like these clock in between like 7 and 11% usually. Yep. Like, and because of, you know, the commented issue of that rye, they're like they have like a really big mouthfeel, and these often like stop fermenting like in the like 10, 20, 10:30 range. Like they're actually pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. And when I think of Sadi, I've never thought of it like that before. So that was kind of interesting. I'm thinking about the style in a new light now, and I've never actually had what I would consider one like a traditional one, but two, no offense to anybody that's brewed one, I haven't tried it, but I haven't had a good one either. So
I've never had a good one. And I believe I only got to try a couple of homebrew versions. You're right. I don't actually think I've ever tried a professional one.
Well, oh, bless you. Oh, I man, was, you couldn't even mute.
No, I was like, trying. I'm trying to mute and I'm trying not to sneeze. I'm sorry. Edit that out later. Yeah. Big monitor. I lost my mouse.
You're good. We'll have to try getting one of those going. Maybe that'll be the last one.
Do that with some other friend.
Yeah. Really.
I don't like it. Like I was going to say, like, I don't think I'd even, even if I had, you know, quote unquote good one, I just don't feel like this is a character that I'd like.
Are you a gin person?
I am a gin person. I love gin, but I am also not a super traditional strong juniper gin person. I tend to like the citrus gins or the barrel aged gins. I mean my favorite gin in the world is from God, why I'm just drawing a complete blank. It's Liberator by I think Valentine distillery over by Fremont or Detroit. It's a barrel-aged gin. I believe it has a traditional juniper base in it, but the barrel really mellows it out.
Maybe episode 100 can be a spirit share or something.
I'm feeling, I know we wanted to do this, you know, brew recipe beer, but I've been thinking, I thought a lot about it this week, and I really want to get together and do the blind tasting of the macros. And I don't know if that's like episode 100 fun, you know, I don't know, get a couple extra people, get together in person. And
sounds like episode 98 fun.
It could be episode 97 fun. We can figure this shit out in the next couple of weeks.
All right, we'll talk about it.
But it's the one I really want to do. So that, I mean, that's just one. Sadi. We talked about Sadi. You know, we can't talk. Let me cross all my Goza shit off. We can't talk about Goza. It's a fucking loser. Got kicked out.
It's too good.
Which, have you brewed any of these? You said no, right? Didn't?
I've brewed none of these.
Okay.
Potentially a Keller beer. But I mean, let's go there. Let's talk about Keller beer.
Real quick, before we do, though, I mean, just to call out, Sadi, I think, is the only one on this list officially that is a non-hopped beer.
I think you're right.
And so just to give honorable mention to Gruitt's, you know, Gruitt's another traditional historical style beer made with mugwort, woodruff, other barks and spices. Yep. Not hops. It's not a hopped beer. Had a really decent one at Beer Cup a few weeks ago. Nikki D.
Oh yeah, it was.
Yeah, the previous organizer of the Michigan Beer Cup had made one heavy on the cranberry. was really tart and really bright. And
I think she's like orange peel in it too, or something like that.
It had a bunch of ingredients in it. So just wanted to call it out. It, you know, Saadi's not the only non-hopped beer. You know, Gruit exists also, and I think Gruit can be a little bit funner, a little bit more creative when you get to play with other ingredients to do that kind of bittering and flavoring, you know, without relying on the hops. So now I can cross that out. But yes, Keller beers. So Keller beers, I feel like you did brew one, didn't you?
Well, here's the thing.
Other people in the club have brewed one.
Keller beer, I feel like, is it's obviously a style. It's in the guidelines. There's breweries out there, you know, in Germany making these beers. But in America, and I wonder about other countries too, I feel like the term is often being thrown onto beer that has been brewed very recently and that the brewery just didn't want to take the time to, you know, filter, clarify or whatever. And they just, they're like, oh, we're just going to call it a Keller beer and throw it out there. Kind of like you throw like an overly bittered, like American pale ale, an IPA or something. It's just.
Cause it's just going by the guidelines. It's a Marzen type lager, and it's other traditional type versions of that are like Munichellas, Dunkel lagers, or other variations based on Pilsners with a more modern,
right,
a spin to it, I guess, with that haziness, right?
And what we see around here is often like a hazy Helles, basically. What I actually didn't know in reading the guidelines is that there are Keller versions of Märzens and Dunkels and you know, German Helles and Pils and stuff like that. Like, I thought it was only like the lighter style lagers, but I guess any style lager can be Keller style, you know. So you can have like a Keller Märzen or a Keller Dunkel. But yeah, it's brewed young and fresh, and it's usually a bit more bright, and the hops are maybe a little bit more present. It's supposed to be very, very drinkable, you know, and you don't care about the beauty of the beer necessarily. It's not chunky or anything like that, but it's not going to be like, you know, super fine. It's just kind of might have a little haze to it or something. And that's okay.
Yeah, it says it can be hazy or cloudy. It should never be murky. It can also have a little more color. It'll be a little bit darker in appearance than the base beer. I feel like this is something that the club went through. I want to say like over the last few months, or maybe, you know, the latter half of last year, I feel like there were a few Keller beers popping up at meetings. I know Wicklund's brewed one. Pretty sure he has. And yeah, I think they're fine. They're good. It's a traditional style, but what I mean, I'll kind of tag into this. I was surprised when I was doing some of the research on these beers, and we talked about it for a second before the show. You know, some of them truly are historical. Some of them are lost to time just because, you know, they were from a small region that kind of died out. Some of them are lost to time because of you know, Germany's Reisengust, right, or the purity law, right. And then some of them are actually just a little kitschy and a little gimmicky and a little funny. You know, there's kind of a broad thing, and I almost kind of wonder if the Keller beer fits into that. Like you said, like, I didn't take the time to, you know, really clarify this beer, so I'm going to slap Keller on it.
and you know, maybe that's what happened. You know, one brewery decided that they didn't want to sit on their beer for, you know, the extra couple of weeks or whatever, and they're like, oh, we're just gonna put this out and market it as something, and it caught on, and then other breweries started doing it too, and then it sort of became a style. And this is all speculation, but it certainly seems like it could have come from, you know.
Well, that, I mean, even in the BJCP guidelines, it does say that it's now been adapted broadly as a marketing term for unfiltered lagers.
So, oh, does it really say that?
Yeah.
Oh, so okay. That's really funny.
So the history category is, it's a marketing term. And to kind of use that as a stepping stone, we can talk about both of them. I don't mean to leave Keller beer behind, but the other one that I thought was funny to find that's all based around marketing is the anything with the pre-prohibition label. I read an interesting article on Brewer's Advocate, BA. They really kind of dug into everybody drinks these or labels pre-prohibitions, as beer being made with traditional grains instead of rice and corn, kind of being the more elegant, recipes that were found before prohibition, where we were putting more quality ingredients in instead of lighter adjuncts. And it's actually not true at all. America has been heavily drinking corn and rice beer since the late 1800s, since mm-hmm. well before prohibition. The article basically went on to say that anybody that claims their beer is a pre-prohibition beer it's a marketing technique. It's a gimmick to kind of say, this is American history.
But you got to call it something, you know.
Yeah, but they're trying to say that they're brewing a beer, a traditional lager style without corn and rice, or from a recipe, passed down from granddad. When in reality, granddad was probably chucking all that corn in.
Well, and those styles, the pre-prohibition stuff. Originated from German immigrants coming over here in the late, 1800s and trying to brew the beers that they liked from, Germany with American ingredients.
Right.
And we have so much, corn, especially back sure. then that that's why it made it into a lot of those lagers and those porters.
And another, I think another thing too is it was just the difference in ingredients that they had. Like you said, they got to America and we didn't really have the two row that was traditional to Germany at that time. We had six row. Mm-hmm. Six row has more protein, has
diastatic power.
Yep, different diastatic power, and it comes out, hazier or darker, and things like that. So. Yeah, it was funny in the history on the BJCP, it talks about immigrant German brewers in the mid 1800s, brewed these lagers, like you said, based on their history, their things. But then, they've slowly kind of weakened in strength and bitterness and popularity after prohibition. Mm-hmm. And then they've been replaced by that standard American lager. The kind of the rice corn lager.
Yeah, the recipes that people have found for the quote unquote pre-prohibition lagers have been pretty high, 5-6%, which is pretty strong for an American lager these days. Yep. That is usually closer to maybe 4.5-5.
Yep.
So the guidelines say that the pre-prohibition lager is probably more like a Czech premium lager. Except with corn, it has that little higher bitterness level to help balance the corn and the slightly higher alcohol and stuff like that. We're not talking about German pills level bitterness, but probably in the IBU range of what a Czech premium would be. So if you were going to brew this, I've never looked for a recipe, but in my mind, if I were to brew a pre-prohibition lager, it would be, I would find a Czech pills recipe maybe. And swap out for American grain. I would use like a six row or two row or something like that. And then I'm not sure how much corn to use. Maybe as much as 40%.
Yeah.
And then use some sort of older American hop like a Cascade or something like that. And whatever lager yeast you can find.
Yeah. No, I agree.
It sounds good. Yeah. I mean, like a Czech lager yeast, maybe. I don't know if diacetyl is appropriate in these beers. 3470 is just an amazing yeast for everything. So,
and these beers have been doing really well. I've tasted
a ton of good ones. Oh yeah.
I've seen them even do well at competitions. pre-prohibition lagers scored quite high. Not in our competition, I'm not speaking to Beer Cup, but I believe I've seen a couple even go best of show. Same thing on the broader term, like if we go into like the Kentucky Commons, I mean, you know, Cookwick's got a great Kentucky Common. He won a couple of medals with, and I think even a couple of best of shows. These historical beers are.
Yeah. I was just that's the most common one that I see, I think.
Kentucky probably. Common.
Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't surprise me if somehow that, like, you know, made it out of historical in the next, you know, 5 years worth of guidelines or something. For as much as I'm seeing it, though, it depends. You know, the BJCP guidelines are sort of based on what homebrewers are doing. It's not written for homebrewers. It's written because of homebrewer contributions.
Right.
And so if enough homebrewers start brewing Kentucky Common where it comes to be like, you know, like, you know, everybody's brewing one or two a year or something like that, kind of like Goza, then, you know, it may find its way back out of historical too. It's funny how things are kind of filtering in and out of that category, maybe. But I mean, let's touch on Kentucky Common. Maybe we can get back to pre-prohibition porter or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I forgot we skipped pre-prohibition porter.
It's fine. I mean, it's basically pre-prohibition lager, like ingredient wise, like Negro Modelo, but with more bitterness and like a little bit more corn, maybe less bitter than an American porter. Less caramel, more smooth. It's the thing about these beers is that like you can describe them with words, but we were never around to taste them. So like all we can do is sort of like use descriptions to try and create a profile in your mind of like what this should taste like compared to things that you've already tasted. And I honestly don't necessarily have a good idea of what this would actually taste like. Again, it's like German immigrants coming over here and making beer with American ingredients. Not that they were drinking porters and stuff like that, but like I'm sure there were dark beers over there at the time. And
actually, I mean, from what what I read on it was, you know, it was really popular during the Revolutionary time where they were trying to brew English beer in America with American ingredients. I read that it evolved as the German immigrants started coming through and started applying, you know, their knowledge to it and, you know, their lager brewing methods. And that kind of evolved up through the second half of the 1800s into, you know, the Prohibition era. But again, it's going to be, it's just going to be that, you know, it's an American adaptation. It's, of porter of, you know, we were over here, different ingredients, different characteristics. You know, our things, you know, probably had, what the flavor profile talks about, a moderate grainy, bready malt flavor, low levels of chocolate, burnt malt, burnt sugar, caramel, you know, so I think the darker porters and stouts that you get out of England, you know, probably had more of those characteristics where this was, you know, just kind of a more malty, less roasty.
So probably brewed with more like caramelized American malts and not necessarily any like black malts or anything like that. Just a lot of like high numbered caramel malts, like 120s and 80s and stuff.
Right. But then still there was still, you know, low amounts of corn and or rice being added to it because it's the characteristic. And also where it talks about characteristic ingredients, it still mentions that kind of 6-row malt again. You know, and corn and molasses, and I don't even know what porterine is, but you know, some of those ingredients using, you know, like molasses as a dark malt, instead of using, you know, a special B or something, you know, that we have access to today.
Kind of going back to the gosh, what's the beer you mentioned at the beginning of the show too? The other historical beer that uses molasses.
Oh, not Buster, not
Cot Buster.
Cot Buster. Cot Buster. We'll get back to Kentucky Common. So, and this was one of the stories that I told Tim I was going to talk about this. So, a Cot Buster is a German beer that was outlawed after the purity laws because it traditionally used molasses, oats, and honey to flavor it. It's still relatively clean lager, but it had those ingredients in there, and the purity laws said that beer could only be barley, water, hops, and yeast. I don't think it called out yeast, right? Because I didn't know that existed. But so this was an outlawed beer, a Cot Buster. It came up in our competition where we had a friend enter a Cot Buster, and it brought to attention, or my attention anyway, that a risk when you're brewing these really obscure historical styles. I mean, I think you're pretty safe with a Kentucky Common. You're pretty safe with a pre-prohibition lager and probably a Rogan beer, but you're probably dancing on edge, with some of the Soddies, maybe even some of the Gruets, and things like this Cot Buster, where you may run into a judge that just doesn't know what the hell this thing is. And they may not even know what a Kentucky Common is or what a Lichtenhainer is. And so this happened to a friend of ours that the judge didn't know what a Cot Buster was, and he judged it as a Goza and judged it pretty poorly. And he even wrote on the sheet, that it was a Goza and called out the lack of salt. But it's because he didn't know what a Cot Buster was. So I think if you are entering into a competition, and you decide to brew a historical beer, be careful or be prepared that could happen. And the other thing is maybe put a little bit more information in your description, because the judges do get whatever you type in that description box, the judges get. I don't know, maybe there's a character limit. And I know Tim did write in there that, it was made with oats and molasses and honey, but it's hard to say what the judge is going to interpret in there, but maybe, put a little bit more detail in there, because some of these historical beers, they may not be familiar with, and it's no fault of the judge. It just, it was a miss, and it happens. So I just wanted to kind of call that out. Some of these obscure styles for comps, people might not be familiar with them, and they may not get judged appropriately. So.
Good call. Thank you.
All right, Kentucky Common.
So this is one of the ones that I've judged most when I have done historical. And I think it's one of the ones that people nail the most commonly as well. Because I feel like there's very clear-cut descriptions of what this beer is and why it's different from other things that are kind of out there right now. The first thing is that it's really low ABV. I mean, we're talking like 3% maybe. I don't have up what the actual
ABV guidelines are, say 4 to 5.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking something. I'm thinking like Pivo or something, but so it's still relatively low. But the carbonation is really, really high. So like we're talking like near sparkling, but also caramely. So like you don't normally have a really, really highly carbonated, like dry, caramely beer. Like I can't think of another one that would be like quite like that. With corn and adjuncts and stuff like that.
All the comparisons I see, even on BJCP and then other sites that I looked at, they really called it like a dark colored version of a cream ale.
Of a what?
Cream ale.
Yeah.
Size of corn.
Yep. I could see that.
Yep. It talks about, the malt flavors are the closest would be like for modern adjunct driven international ambers or dark lagers or Irish red ales or Belgian pale ales. It's going to have that real, kind of creamy, corny, flavor with the dark malt additions, you know?
I mean, when I first started seeing these come out too, I remember reading arguments online about whether they're supposed to be sour or not too. And the guidelines mentioned this too, but yeah, there was discussion about, you know, old brewing techniques and sour mashes and stuff like that, and whether this should have like any like lactic sourness or something. And for whatever reason, there must be like books or recipes or something out there that people are following that discuss like getting a little bit of like tartness into the beer style. But as far as I can tell, and as far as like, you know, the actual, you know, like Gordon Strong or whoever else, you know, helped write the BJCP guidelines can figure, there's no mention of actually creating a Kentucky Common with any of that like tart, taste or anything.
An article I read today actually was, it talked about using a Kentucky Common was really primarily from around that Louisville era and area of Kentucky. And it was pretty much the same grain bill back then as bourbon. And so they were doing the same kind of mashing techniques. And it did call out, you know, there were sour mash techniques, the same that they would do for bourbon, instead of, you know, distilling it and putting it into a barrel to age. They just took the wort, put it in the barrel, sealed it up very tightly, and allowed it to completely ferment in that barrel with the same kind of sour mash grain bill from bourbon. And I think that's where some of that sour characteristics, and even BJCP calls it out. And they do say if a soured version is fine, but you should enter it in mixed fermentation sour beer. It should be category 28, not 27.
I wonder if that's where it came from too, because sour mashing doesn't actually produce like a sour flavor. It's like, it's like a weird, it's a weird, weirdly named thing. Yeah.
I wonder. It's funny because their notes say that no records indicate sour mashing or even sour profile in the beer. But the article I read actually from it was a historical site about Kentucky talked about sour mashing. So it's like, I don't know. You know, Google foo. But I did think it was kind of cool. They put it in barrels. They sealed it up, like you said, or they sealed it up so that it would be carbonated, like you said, and it would basically, you know, be allowed just to completely ferment and carbonate in this barrel, and it's going to come out this, you know, sparkling dark variant of a cream ale.
Not too dark. We're talking like
darker.
Yeah. Like an oxidized cream ale, like that sort of light brown, you know, gold kind of caramely color. Is all the ones that I've had.
Again, some of the characteristic ingredients, you know, call out 6-row barley malt because that's what we had and that's what they use in bourbon. Corn grits, and then some, you know, some use some small amounts of caramel and black malts, using rustic American bittering hops, and then high carbonate water.
Easy until you try it. I feel like it's hard to balance the caramel flavor in those beers sometimes and still make it like really drinkable and get the color right and stuff. So if you want a good recipe, go, you know, go find Dan Kukuk on Facebook and add him as a friend.
There you go.
Ask him for his recipe. He'll really love that. Keller Beer, Kentucky Common, London Brown Ale.
Yeah, I don't understand why this fits into historical like this, because I don't feel like it really died off or went away. But
well, I don't think I've ever had anything quite like this, commercially. At least reading the style guidelines for it, I did judge one at the Siciliano's homebrew competition, and it didn't really hit the marks because the marks are kind of weird. So again, I hope I get this one right. This is one of those 2.8 to like 3.5 ABV ones, right?
Yes.
So it's supposed to be really, really low ABV, but like really, really sweet at the same time. Like the final gravity for these is like in the 10-15 range. Yep. So you're only starting off at like 10-35, 10-40 or something like that. Like,
yeah, they actually talk you about, they talk about, you know, stabilizing and back sweetening.
No, really?
Yeah. Commercial versions can be pasteurized and back sweetened, which gives more sugary sweet flavor.
What are you back sweetened with? Like just straight up sugar? Or maybe like DME or something? That's interesting. Okay. That's cool. I missed that part.
They talk about it. It's interesting. So this is straight off the BJCP site. They say that frequently used as a sweet mixer with cask mild and bitter in pubs, commercial versions can be pasteurized and back sweetened, which gives a more sugary sweet flavor.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really cool. I could see that being really fun to give just like a, you know, regular bitter, like a kick or something like that.
I mean, it goes into like, you know, kind of reminds me of that, like the black and tan and why you do black and tans, or you know, why
I don't know why. Tell me.
I feel like the original you know, purpose of a black and tan was they didn't want, you know, it's kind of like that shandy, you know, I don't want all of the hops in this, so I'm gonna, you know, cut it with, you know, this porter, or vice versa. And and I think it was more, I'm totally stretching because it's been a long time since I read about this, but I actually think that that kind of shit, it was more popular in England, you know, historically was, you know, back then breweries had one kind of beer. You know, they carried beer from, or a pub, I'm sorry, not a brewery, a pub carried a beer from, you know, a particular brewer. And they only served, you know, those two or three beers. I just think it was a way to kind of add variety. But now I'll have to double check.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I know, I think this was a thing in at least some parts of Germany for a while. Maybe this was England too. My sense of history is failing me right now, but if you wanted to open like a pub, you could talk to a brewery and the brewery would essentially like sponsor you and help you set up your pub. But in order for your assistance in setting that up, you could only serve their beer. Yep. And often it was, like you said, one type. So that would make a lot of sense. You know, if you had something like that to sort of, yeah.
So a quick Google search, actually calls it out to be a taxing issue back in the 1700s.
Okay.
Different beers were taxed at different rates, and so it was a way to get it cheaper.
So many things fall back to in history.
Yeah, taxes. But I think more recently I remember talking to people that are drinking it more for the mellowing, the flavoring. Kind of like the shandying. I actually remember a friend of mine, Ed Nash, you know, from Arclight, talking people into shandying beers that would come into his brewery. You know, like they don't like beer, they don't want to try beer, they don't like this, or, you know, IPAs scare them, and he would talk them into a shandy. My cousin was one of them, and the next thing you know, after a few months, she's just drinking straight, you know, wit. Or whatever.
Yeah, 100%. There's still breweries that are mixing beers, not even, you know, like to try to be subtle about it, but like at that One Well, you can get their coffee blonde and mix it with a donut porter that they have, or a donut stout, I guess, and, you know, it ends up being this sort of like nice, lighter, coffee, sweet sort of, you know, chocolate drink. It's really good. I think that's something that's probably going to get a little bit more popular in the next 5 years, is like blending beers and stuff like that. I feel like I've called it out like a couple of years ago, because I thought that's where a lot of like new innovation in beer was going to come from. But that's interesting to know about the London Brown Ale. So that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a lower ABV, sweeter, stout, less roasty. So it's going to be a less roasty, sweeter version of a traditional English stout or porter.
So. I think that was the issue with the one that I judged. You know, the one time was that it wasn't sweet and it was very thin and, you know, it was very highly carbonated. And this is, I guess that's a really good way to put it. Like, imagine this is more of a mixing beer to make lighter beers more interesting. And if you feel like you have that, then you're probably on the right track. What we got?
On my list, that leaves Roggenbier and Lichtenhainer, and I don't know shit about Lichtenhainer.
did we talk about Pivo Grodzicki?
Oh, no. I caught, for some reason, I crossed that out, too. I don't really know much about Pivo Grodzicki. It's a smoked beer. So
it's a smoked wheat beer. That's not sour. Yeah. Yeah.
And probably probably just automatically shut off in my head because it's fucking smoked beer. So
the breweries that are still brewing this that I'm aware of are pretty much only the ones that produce their own smoked malts. I'm trying to think of one. There's a Czech brewery that's producing something that's probably very similar to what this beer is. But yeah, they do all their beers with wheat malt, or not wheat malt, but with smoked malt. And I'd assume that they probably have some sort of like smoked wheat beer. Jake is actually drinking a homebrew Rockin' beer, so we'll get to that next too. Yeah, I don't know if I've ever had like a Pivo Grodzicki. Not a lot of people I know really like smoke in their beer, because you know, if you have 5 gallons of it and you're too heavy handed on the smoke, like you can have a beer that just sits around for a long time and then gets dumped. I feel like smoke is very, very hard to do well. I do like well done smoked beers. I know you can't necessarily do those, but
I will tell you that, I was really busy at Michigan Beer Cup judging, and I didn't get a chance to try a lot of the beers or meads. But on Sunday I had a moment, and there was the table, you know, set to the side with all of the already judged beers that were there for the stewards and staff to drink and try. And I just randomly walked up and grabbed a mead and poured a glass of it and took a big old drink of it, and it was smoked. And I
thought, no,
I was like, what the fuck? What are my chances? And it's horrible. So,
well, again, it's supposed to be like a really low ABV, like under 3.2. So my best recommendation, if you were to want to brew one of these, would be to, again, use wheat. Use the best quality smoked malt you can find, and probably like I wonder like if you can even do this, but I wonder if you can like weigh out kernels, like you know, 5 you know smoke kernels and like 50 others, and sort of like do a mix, or you know, grab 1 smoked kernel and you know, 10 regulars and eat them and just see if you know, yeah, can get like any of that smoke flavor. Or for sure, you know, go and see if there's any recipes already existing on like the AHA website or something. But
to me, it sounds like a beer that doesn't want to be any other beer. Like it they call it out, like similar in strength to a Berliner Weiss, never sour, much more bitter, has a smoked character, but not as much as a Rausch beer. Lower gravity than a Lichtenhainer, but more bitter, not sour. You know, more bitter than a Goza, but no salt. So it's like all of these little regional, you know, zones in Germany that it's from. It's kind of like all of those, but not like any of those.
But if you brew one, send it to us so we can do a homebrew review.
Send it to Brian.
You'll take a sip.
And I'll nod and smile.
Well then we'll go to Jake's Roggenbier.
Roggenbeer, and Jake's Roggenbeer in particular. So Roggenbeer, it's like a Dunkelweiss made with rye rather than wheat. It's great body, light finishing hops. The rye gives it that bready, fruity, peppery, creamy body. I actually really do enjoy Roggenbeers. In fact, when I had Jake's a couple of years ago, I remember pushing him to get us a keg for Homebrew Fest, and I think he did. It was fantastic. I believe it's won in the past. So yeah, Jake, just a shout out to Jacob Downey for his Roggenbeer. It's great.
No, so you said it's like a Dunkelweiss. Does that use like the Weizen yeast too? Like the
You're gonna look for that banana clove characteristics of the Weizen yeast. For some reason, in a darker beer, I feel like those fit better to me. Like, I'm not a huge Hefe. I'm not a big banana clove Weizen yeast characteristic fan, but in the Roggenbeers, I believe the rye gives it the balance that it needs, kind of that spiciness. So
I really like the body that rye brings to a beer. I do a rye wine once a year or so, and it's super good. Oh yeah.
Yep.
I remember that now. Yep. Yeah.
Super delicious. Big Yellow Truck at Territorial Brewing. It was on tap there that year. It's super good.
Matt Jaggers from Jaggers Brewing Co. YouTube is here. So, man, don't worry, Matt. We're mostly talking out of our ass. It's fun. Yeah,
that's what we do.
Mostly talking about how I'd go about brewing all these, probably. But yeah, Lori says Larry did a Roggenbeer 55% reet. Yeah, lots of rye salts. 100%.
You're gonna get sticky, nasty gook if you don't. Yeah.
If you don't do a beta glucanase rest or beta, I think that's what it's called. You will get a lot of sticky wort. I think I use like 2 pounds of rice hulls in my my rye wine grist. It's pretty crazy. Yeah.
But no, I mean, I it's another one. Like, I feel like Roggenbeer.
That is probably one of the other more common ones.
More common, like the Kentucky common. I would say probably maybe even second place now that Goza's not in here anymore. Mm-hmm.
Matt says he uses about a pound of rice hulls in his Roggenbeer. I'm assuming you mean rice hulls, not rye. Yeah, rice hulls. I really think that tops off Roggenbeer. I mean, probably like, ferment it like you would a Dunkelweiss too. Like, those are hard beers because you sort of have to really navigate the temp control a lot to sort of control those, phenolics and esters and stuff. And there's, ferulic acid rests you can do, and you can probably do like beta glucan rests and stuff. And I feel like that's one of the more scientific and sort of manipulable styles that's on this list right now. But again, it's also probably one of those beers that if homebrewers keep making it, it may not be in historical anymore, because I see Roggenbeer all the freaking time at homebrew club meetings and in competitions and stuff. And I don't necessarily see why it wouldn't pop out of historical maybe if people keep brewing it,
I feel like it's definitely one that I see more frequently. Yeah, even at breweries around here, I feel like I've seen Roggenbeers, not at all of them, but it's been around. And reading the comments on BJCP, it's actually still regularly produced. It was purchased, the original beer that created the style brewed in Regensburg, Bavaria, was purchased by Polliner, but it's a regional brand there, and it's hard to find as an export. I agree with you. I think it could easily pop out of historical and go back into kind of either category it's of its own, or maybe even a subcategory of up in the Weizen categories.
Yeah. which would be cool. I guess that kind of makes me think too, and maybe you have more experience of this because you were kind of running the back of house for the Michigan Beer Cup. And Matt, congrats on your medal, sir. I'm assuming, is that your no-chill room temp fermentation for a Roggen beer? Or just in general, you want a medal with something, but congrats. But
I think he's... You're not calling out some... Didn't we give you some shit, or didn't I make some comment about no-chill and...
Oh my God, I think I do remember that.
I think so.
Yeah, he's
or no, it was no here. It was no boil. No, I'm oh, okay. I know we joked around about something, but no, congrats. Yeah, congrats on the Ryan Bill.
But so these styles, they're not judged as a flight of 27s, right? Are these usually mixed into other categories? Like are you judging Roggen beer with, say, like, you know, Dunkel's Weiss, like at the end or something? And judging porter, like pre-prohibition porter with like English porter?
No, these were not. So the way we did judging, really? This year, you know, we definitely did queue judging, which I know we've talked about here. I'm actually getting into my sheets. So
is this who you were talking shit to about the noble? No chill.
I don't know. I do not believe that I was talking shit about no chill. I think I made, I don't know, Matt will correct me, but I thought I made a joke about no boil.
No chill is amazing. It just requires knowledge that I for sure don't have, and equipment. I don't even know if we can get those cubes that the Australians use for their no chill. You know, have you ever seen those?
No, I don't. I actually have no idea.
They're like cubes, plastic cubes that can withstand boiling temps, and you make your beer and you fill up the cube and stick it, you know, in your closet or whatever, and just kind of wait until it chills down.
I'll have to do some
correct research. Me if I'm wrong, Dibs.
But to how we judge it. So we actually had, we had 10 entries in historical in 27, and they were all judged together. And so we give the judges the opportunity to organize, you know, so they get the list, you know, and in our case, we had a Keller beer, we had 3 Kentucky Commons, we had a PWO, we had 2 pre-prohibitions, 2 Roggen beers, and then Tim's Cotbuster. And we kind of, you know, show them the list, and they get to kind of arrange it, you know, how they want them to come out. But in the end, yeah, I mean, all of these beers are, you know, lined up in a mini boss together, and they're up against each other.
Huh. So I didn't realize that's how we had it set up. That's interesting.
Not split out into. I mean, I get what you're saying. Like,
you think,
know,
we should
put loggers into loggers and Kentucky Commons, and I don't know. That's a conversation that we should have with our head judge next year.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if it's. I don't know. I'm gonna have to go and look and see how other competitions did it. Matt, was your Roggen beer judged in like its own category of 27, like historical stuff?
Yeah,
I don't know. I actually don't. Yeah, I don't mind it either way, but I could definitely see it both ways.
It I mean, I could too. I guess the question would be like, where do you put
that? Would be like, less medals overall to give out, though, you know, too.
It would eliminate the 27 medal category.
Yeah, so okay. Keep it on its own.
But I mean, I would say too, you know, like some of them are easy to split out, you know, Kentucky Commons, you know, the Roggen beer, you know, I can see that. But, you know, you have the other ones like the PWOs or the PWO, sorry, or the Gruets and Soddies. Like what would you put that with?
Yeah, no, I don't know. Alternate fermented beers.
Or spice.
It's not alternate fermentables. Yeah.
So we had enough of them. Like I said, we had 10, we judged them in their own flight. And And I think, you know, I'm looking at scores and, you know, the results on that one. And I think it was evenly distributed.
So. Yeah. Jake said it's kind of a mix for him. Matt says he hates when it goes into other categories. I can probably see that when historical gets like two entries or something.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It has I to mean, go even like we did a really, we really tried hard to keep the categories separate. Like even in categories where I think we had two categories that had three entries in. So logistically I had to combine them with a flight, to, you know, send it out and, you know, kind of keep the judge teams even. Mm-hmm. But I did actually on both of those cases, I spoke to the judges directly and said, you know, these three beers are getting first, second, and third, and these three beers are getting first, second, and third, and I'm awarding places as if they're separate. But, you know, just for time and logistics, I'm having you judge these two little tiny categories, and they did that just fine. And
yeah,
and
we want to give away medals.
We do, and it's one of those categories is the only one that we actually only gave away two medals in. The third beer just didn't score high enough to even justify a medal. So. No, giving away spoilers, but
all right, Matt, thanks for hopping on.
So then the last one that we haven't talked about in depth is Lichtenhainer, and I know nothing about it other than it's a smoky goza and it sounds disgusting. So
yeah, it's the BJCP guidelines kind of describe it as like a goza, Grodzicki, Berliner Weiss mashup, but yeah, a little bit smoky, like a smoked goza, but no coriander, no salt. So this one is sour though, right?
Yes, it should have a tingly acidity, high carbonation, and it should have a smoke and sour, unusual combination.
Yeah,
and they actually call it out that it can be an acquired taste. So characteristic ingredients would be smoked barley malt, wheat malt, lacto, top fermenting yeast. You know, grists, they say vary, but it should typically be 30-50% wheat. You know, it's definitely another one of those lower ABV, 3-4%, you know, really dry beer, you know, finishing out at, you know, 10.04, 10.08. And yeah, like, I mean, smoke and sour to me just sounds
not super pleasant.
Awful. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would really like a good example. Like, I think if I had like a well-made one, I would probably like it. Cause sometimes some of those like sour beer phenolics can give a bit of like a smoky presence. So as long as it's not too overdone, like it might be kind of okay, but yeah, I can totally get like, if it was like a smoke bomb and also sour, it would just taste like, yeah, not good.
On a side note, I'm looking up now because I'm just so damn curious on what
you're fine. You look
like cubing your fucking beer is.
And yeah. So Dib says in cubes last for 6 months. No worries. So. Cause yeah, it's all pasteurized at that point. Right. So as long as you don't let anything in, what, you just take the wort and you toss it in a fermenter later and make beer with it. Like, so tell me, Dibs, can you make like 20 gallons of wort at a time and like pour it into like four different cubes? And then just like, when you want to make a beer, just take a cube out and ferment it and, you know, make some beer with it. Is that kind of the point? Or cause I totally understand no chill too, being like, you finish your beer and pour it into your HDPE container and go and clean and, you know, come back to the next day and continue on your brew day. I love breaking up my brew day, but yeah, I'm interested to.
We might have to look into this. I'm very curious. And actually I want to go, I'll have to go read this. There was a Brewlosophy experiment done on it.
Well, I think that's one of the concerns. He says, like, any HDPE 5 gallon container will work. Just defer your hop additions by 15 minutes. And so I think, yeah, that's often like the worry is that, right, if you do like a late hop edition or something like that, because you're not chilling it really quick, more of those alpha acids are going to isomerize. Yeah. So you sort of have to maybe think about your IBUs and yeah, adjust the quote unquote, you know, time that it's actually going to be isomerizing for when you're like doing the recipe.
Yeah. But anyway, that's not historical beer and we do like to jump topics. But it is a neat technique I wasn't familiar with. So we'll look into that. What else do we have? I think we covered it.
So we're going to talk about what we have coming up for episodes for a minute. I think you wanted to push that to the end of the show.
Yeah, we've got this great list. And I know Gail's been busy and I know she's at HomebrewCon right now. And actually shout out to all of our friends that are at HomebrewCon and maybe listen to this later, but I hope you guys are having a great time. But you know, we're going to some highlights that come up, you know, from our show list. We still need to hit, get Gail on to do a guided kind of tasting.
Mm-hmm.
We had called out that we were going to talk about, you know, blending beer, mead, cider, sours. That was a possible show idea. I really want to do the macro lager blind tasting. And then, yeah, there's a bunch of others. We got to figure out the episode 100 show. So I think coming up in the near future, you're going to see the macro lager, and then talk more around episode 100. One of the topics that we may talk about is beer flavoring, using different extracts, different concentrates, different things like that. So that reminded me, I want to give a shout out to, and then she'll probably never see this, but I met the rep for Amaretti for the East Coast, and she was awesome enough to send our club a box of Amaretti flavors, which are amazing. To use in beers. Brian's actually won a gold medal with a beer made
with their gin flavor. Or with
Moscow Mule
syrup.
Yeah. So I think I'd like to dive into that some more because a lot of the people in the club have been doing buys through Tim of the Coloma Foods concentrates. I have done beers with the Coloma Fruit concentrates, and they've turned out really good. And I'm excited to keep diving into that more. So that might be something that we can get a couple of the guys on. Brandon and Tim. Maybe we can talk about some Coloma Fruit concentrates and some other extracts and flavorings for beer.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But macro lager, I want to put it together. Maybe it is episode 97.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
Yeah. Other than that, I think, we're getting ready to kick into planning for Homebrew Fest. For those of you that are in Michigan, if you listen to the show and you're not in a homebrew club or you're not coming to Homebrew Fest, please reach out or look into it, man. It is the best homebrew party, together, whatever you want to call it. It's we have between 18 and 20 clubs show up, probably between 200 and 300 taps of homebrew on over the course of a long weekend, Friday, Saturday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We do a lot of activities together. There's food, there's parties, there's music, there's all kind of good-natured drunken tomfoolery. So I should absolutely come check it out. It's going to be August 18th and 19th, third weekend in August. And you can look it up at michiganhomebrewfest.com or Michigan Homebrew Fest on Facebook. So that's what we are getting ready for. It's only 8 weeks away.
Less than awesome. Away. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. So other than that, that's it.
I think you're right. I guess to recap, you know, some of these historical styles. If you brew any, for sure, let us try some. Love to circle back on this. I might try to brew like a Kentucky Common or a Roggen beer sometime soon here, because that sounds pretty good. Kentucky Common, when it's warm out, sounds pretty refreshing. So might give that a shot.
Basically, step outside your comfort zone, brew different shit. These are interesting things. And, you know, maybe for your area or your homebrew club, it's something that is that is new and hasn't been tried before. And so you kind of be the expert for your club and
bring you some. We'll pay for shipping to get it to us too. You don't have to, if you don't live local, I promise.
That's right. But yeah, basically just brew different shit. Have fun homebrewing.
Sweet. All right, man. Well, I'm good if you're good. Everybody, thank you again. We'll catch you on episode 97. Maybe it'll be the macro beer tasting, blind tasting. I hope so. We'll see.
Figure it out. Thanks, guys.
Cheers.